The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 189.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show one of my favorite people on this planet Earth.
Wow.
She is absolutely amazing. She is my great friend, Lynette Zhang. Lynette, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Wow. Well, back at you, George. You're one of my favorite people, too, and I'm very happy to be here today.
All right. So usually I tell the people I interview to go over a quick background. Nobody needs to know your background. They all know who Lynette Zhang is. So let's go right into the good stuff. I was just glancing at your YouTube channel. I saw you've got some recent videos you have. The titles looked amazing. It looked really, really cool. A lot of the things that I've been thinking about myself. So the first thing I'd like you to explain, and I'm going to read right off my notes here, is your thumbnail in the video was talking about the IMF credit score. And I know you've really studied the IMF extensively. Mm-hmm. So can you go over what you were talking about in that video, and let's just go back and forth on it.
Okay. Well, what I'm really talking about is the way they're setting up the whole digital system that really enables them to have a lot more control on what the individuals can do. Because right now, we're separated, right? The IMF does everything through the banks. But as we're moving forward and moving more into this digital age, well, then they're going to have absolutely direct access to the individual. And they're going to definitely monitor that and control that access. But that also enables them to control how the individual moves forward. Whether it's financial or it's with anything else. So that's what I'm really referring to in there. And additionally, the IMF looks at different countries and gives them a different credit score.
Yeah, right.
So in their lending facility, that gives them more control there as well.
So how do you think they'll take control over the individual? Do you think they'll do that by introducing a digital SDR, and then that will be a medium of exchange? Or how do you see it playing out?
Well, keep in mind that what's happening right now with roughly, and I'm going to be diving into this more next week.
Okay.
On a global basis, you have the global central banks all examining working on converting their currencies into digital currencies, which would then translate into the IMF basket.
Right.
And it makes it, once everything is really digital, it makes it much easier for the IMF to control the weighting and who is in that basket. Mm. So where the Fed would actually have the direct control to the individuals, the IMF would have the direct control over the central banks.
Right. Got it.
Right. So easy to translate policy, much easier than the current system.
Yeah, right. I did a video the other day where I was reading a blog post from Christine Lagarde.
Oh.
And this is when she was head of the IMF, so a couple years ago. And she was talking about how in the future, the person that goes to the store and buys beer and pizza through AI, we could find out that they have a higher default rate on their mortgage compared to the person that goes to the store and buys organic broccoli and spring water, implying that with that data, we could charge or know the perfect interest rate to charge the person that buys beer and pizza, or we could charge the person that buys the broccoli and spring water, or whatever we deem appropriate, we being the global elite, we could charge that person a lower rate of interest What do you think about that? I know it didn't
I think that's
you.
Called nudging.
Right.
And that's really a lot of what we're talking about here. Yeah, it's giving the IMF and giving all the central bankers, because the IMF is every central banker and every treasury head, secretary. So that's who the IMF is. So that's how they get that direct control to the individual, and yeah, and nudging you. Or maybe they actually want you to eat beer and pizza because it supports the medical, the pharmaceutical enterprises too, right? They've been subsidizing that for a long time, not subsidizing the broccoli eaters.
And you know, one thing I've been thinking about a lot that I don't know a lot of people are talking about is the difference between a commercial bank and a central bank from the standpoint of lending. What I'm referring to specifically is a commercial bank is a private entity, or we'll call it semi-private nowadays, but they have a P&L. They have a profit, they have a loss, and they have a balance sheet. They need to be solvent. They can't have negative equity or they're bust. Whereas a central bank, theoretically, they don't have a P&L. They can issue a loan and they really don't have to worry about being paid back. They have an infinite balance sheet. They can have negative equity. I've heard some people on Twitter, some experts on FinTwit, say there are central banks, in fact, that are still functioning that do have negative equity. So how would that change the dynamic in lending if people were borrowing from the central bank, an entity that didn't have to worry about a P&L?
Well, I think we're experiencing that right now, because in essence, we are all doing modern money theory,
right,
by just creating this money out of thin air. And, you know, also in theory, you're right, because they create the money so they can always repay the debt. That's why most government debt is also AAA rated, because it's full faith and credit.
Right.
So that's going to have a huge, that's why confidence is so important.
Mm.
Because you really, honestly, tell me one central bank that actually has a positive P&L balance sheet. They don't, because what they've taken on is all garbage. So
right.
How can somebody's debt that can never be repaid, or those derivative bets, the legacy bets that they bought off of all the banks' balance sheets, the commercial banks' balance sheets.
Like mortgage-backed securities, right?
Exactly. Okay, you tell me how they have any value. They cannot sell them into the marketplace.
Right. Or another thing, I don't think I've heard a lot of people talk about, is if the Fed does yield curve control, if they explicitly do yield curve control, then almost by definition, they're buying bonds that have a lower yield than the rate of inflation. And if they keep those bonds, assuming that they can't reduce the size of the balance sheet, they might get paid back in nominal terms, but they're going to be paid back with cheaper dollars, and therefore they're going to be losing a lot of purchasing power if they couldn't just wave the magic wand and create more bank reserves. But my main point for the viewer and the listener is to point out that a central bank can lend, if they merge the treasury, let's say, we'll talk about that later, the government or the central bank can lend on things other than a person's ability to pay back the loan. So they could use a social score, or they could use any objective they so choose. And in one of my recent videos, I was talking about how they may use that power to really shut down, like, Trump supporters, as an example.
Right.
And I know the people that watch my videos that might not like Trump say, oh, well, that's a good thing. But then I also mentioned that's a double-edged sword. That's right. It gives them ability to also shut down Black Lives Matter or whatever group that you're in favor of. So the bottom line is we need less government power, but how do you see them yield or using that power in the future, like 2-3 years down the line, if we had this system play out that you're talking about? So the digital SDR is controlling the central banks. The central banks have their own digital currency that's being used within the real economy of each country. How would that change the average Joe and Jane's life on a daily basis, do you think?
Actually, I think it will change the average Joe and Jane's life by an extreme amount. And again, it's because of what they call nudging you in the direction that they want you to go in. Right. And this would be, I mean, they've been doing that forever. And financial repression, you know, I have to bring that up because you mentioned if they explicitly do yield curve control. But yeah. In reality, if you look at a graph on the interest rates, they've really been using as an admitted tool, financial repression for a very long time particularly since 2008. By dropping those interest rates down to zero and keeping them there. So how has that impacted Joe and Jane, the savers, the people that are trying to generate income? It has pushed them out on the risk spectrum.
Right.
And that's even with quasi-control. When they have absolute direct control and they want you to spend, they will just take you deeply into negative territory so that you can watch your principal evaporate knowing you're not spending it. And that will inspire you to go out and spend on anything to try and hold its value.
Right.
So,
which somehow helps the economy.
Yeah.
Inflation
helps the economy.
Right. Right.
Inflation simply enables the central bankers and the powers that be. It's really a substitution for real growth.
Yeah,
we haven't had real growth in this economy since 97, which is when we peaked out on that debt, if you look at the monetary velocity chart, right?
Yeah,
so 97 was the last time taking on debt actually was truly stimulative to the economy.
Because productive debt.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. It stimulated the stock market. Mm. Right?
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, no. Once they have everything digital and they have absolutely direct control, I mean, what I love is that they are calling this, and it is, programmable money.
Yeah, right.
With controllable anonymity.
Hmm.
Let that sink in for a second. Programmable money, controllable anonymity. So when you're talking about the groups and their ability to shut them down, you know, they'll be able to do that with the individuals as well.
Yeah. And I think I'd love to get your opinion on this. And I'm sure I'm going to piss off a lot of people, but you know, it is what it is. I personally think that some groups in the United States, the people who are really in favor of being overly politically correct, you know, they've taken a word such as racist and they've expanded it so wide. And now it's such a general term that it really has lost all meaning. You know, when you and I were growing up, I mean, that term really had a lot of meaning. I mean, if you called someone that was extremely impactful. Now, it's just thrown out there when anyone doesn't like something, or you know, it's just again, it's just so general, it has no real meaning anymore. And I'm concerned they start doing that with the phrase domestic terrorist. And again, it goes back to, I know a lot of people are going to be saying, well, you know, what the people who are being labeled that right now, it's appropriate because of what they did. And I'm not here to say that it's right or wrong or get on that discussion, but I am here to say that be very careful what you wish for, because that group that you're labeling that now, whatever group you like could be labeled that in the future. And I think that we're just going down this path, especially when you combine that phrase with the verbiage in the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. That if you are, and I hate to piss off YouTube here, so we'll call it a DT, abbreviate. If you're a DT, then a lot of your rights as an American citizen due to the Patriot Act completely vanish. And yes. I'm worried that that's going to encompass more and more people according to the political narrative in the mainstream media in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually think that there's a lot of accuracy in what you see, what you say, what you're saying, and that it's expanded also into those few technology companies that have the ability to shut down anybody that they just don't like what they're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there are some things that I would definitely agree should, I can't say the word should, because in a free world, we all have the right to say what we want to say, but we're not really in a free world. I don't like the private corporations having that level of control over free speech. Yeah. That makes me really, really nervous. I think it makes a lot of people really nervous.
Yeah, but you know, I talked about principles the other day, Lynette, on a video. And the thought I was trying to communicate is if we truly have principles, that means like freedom of speech as an example. If we truly believe in freedom of speech and we're principled, then we should, the definition is by allowing someone to say something that we don't like.
Like, exactly.
It's allowing someone to say something that might offend us. It might even be allowing someone to say something that we think is dangerous. If we just change, you know, who we apply freedom of speech to and what we apply it to, then we really don't have principles. We're just feeding into like this religious tribalism. Do you see that happening around us today?
I definitely do. And I mean, I think everybody knows that I would think that most people pay a whole lot more attention to what they say before they say it these days. I mean, certainly we do on YouTube because we don't want to get shut out of YouTube.
Right.
Because that has the biggest, broadest audience. Right. And so we really do have to pay attention. But I would also say from a personal experience, you know, I think people can really relate to this too. Without going into too much detail, you know, years and years ago, there was a really rough patch in my family, right? Mm. And everybody talks about unconditional.
Right.
But when push comes to shove, what are you willing to do to stand up for those values? Because to me, unconditional means unconditional. Under no condition will I abandon you.
Right.
Or turn my back on you. I may not like what you say. I may totally disagree with your choices. I may even hate what you say and do. But I'm not. It's unconditional. And it's the same thing. And I agree with that.
Same thing with freedom of speech, yeah.
Exactly. It's the same thing. Freedom of speech means freedom of speech. What I really don't like, and the way that I think a lot of things are being used, is to hide the truth.
Yeah, right.
So much truth is being hidden or wrapped around, well, we're doing this for your own good, but the reality is Main Street is dying. Main Street is in so much pain.
Yeah.
From all of this stimulus. It hasn't stimulated Main Street. It has stimulated Wall Street. So we have this huge K-shaped recovery.
You're right.
And that's true on the boots on the ground. And it's true actually in corporations. Larger corporations, larger businesses that have access to Wall Street, they're doing great. Hey, look at their stocks. They're up. Hey, it's the end of January and we're up 12%, 15%, 7%, whatever, right? But the smaller businesses, and certainly the mom and pop that are really the job generator of this world, or this country anyway, they're closing up at alarming rates.
Yeah. You see all those big corporations that got bailed out. And I was reading a statistic the other day that 60% of the small businesses that had to close down due to, we'll call it the Cervasa sickness lockdown, are closed down forever.
Exactly.
They're not coming back. There's no V-shaped recovery there. They are gone. Those jobs are gone. Those businesses are gone. And they don't, you can't just create an additional, let's call it 100, 200, 300,000 businesses overnight. That's going to take a long time to come back. And with the regulatory environment or the tax environment, I mean, who knows if it ever comes back. You know, one thing I wanted to have you expand on, and I think this is kind of what you're saying, and I want to make sure people really start thinking about this, because since 1971, or call it since 1981, we've been told that inflation has been relatively tame. And you and I would both agree that the CPI understates inflation. But I was speaking with Robert Breedlove the other day, real smart guy. And he's kind of I guess I'd call him a Bitcoin enthusiast, but he knows macro too. He's not just a Bitcoin guy. And he made a great point. He was talking about since 1971 or 73, right around there, you see the chart of productivity.
Oh, yes.
Continue to go straight up. I'm sure you know the chart I'm talking about.
I totally do.
And then you also see the chart of real wages just kind of start to flatten out. Yeah, if not go down.
Go down.
And he was talking about the inflation that we didn't see. So the Fed was producing this 2, 3, 4% inflation per annum compounded over time, that we look at that and say, well, that's not too bad. But what we don't see is the deflation we would have had as a result of the productivity gains. And the deflation would have meant a higher standard of living and those wages, those real wages, actually going up instead of flat. So I think his whole point, and what I've never heard anyone really talk about this, and I don't think the average Joe and Jane, even the people that listen to our channel, have really thought about it, but we can't measure inflation from 0 to 1 or 0 to 3. I think we have to measure the delta, right? If we would have had 10% deflation, which would have been a benefit to the consumer, but yet the print is 2% inflation. Well, we didn't have 2% inflation. We had 12% inflation, because that's the purchasing power that's being robbed from the consumer.
Exactly. And they knew that inflation causes that nominal confusion. So, you know, average wage, $9,571. Today, I think it's $52,000 or something like that. And on the surface, you go, well, yeah, I'd rather have that $52,000 than that $9,500. But you could, a family of four could live on one wage at $9,500. And at $52,000, I mean, at $75,000, they're giving you a stimulus check. At $150,000 for two people, you're getting two stimulus checks.
Right.
Because, yeah. And it really, that, you know, it really does go back to the whole design of the system. And in 1971, critically, what the government did was hand over full control of inflation to a private central bank.
Yeah, or semi.
And they know debt.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. And before we get into that, I just want to make sure that I'm clear to the people who are watching us that maybe are on the left, that when we are talking about freedom of speech, I'm not just being critical of those on the left. I'm being critical of everybody. Because I think if you turn the tables and the social media companies were banning, let's say, Black Lives Matter or Antifa or something like that, the people on the right would be saying, oh, yeah, good job, social media company. And then the people on the left would be complaining about freedom of speech. So it all goes back to being principled and not being tribal. But anyway, okay, so we talked about, or you were talking about the central banks, the government, and maybe merging the two. So I want to talk about NFT. I want to talk about Janet Yellen being hired or elected as the Treasury Secretary and what could happen. And you heard her speech the other day, I'm sure, where she's talking about the need to act big.
Big.
Those were her words, which exactly. Just basically means more money printing. What are your thoughts about that whole thing and Janet Yellen being the Treasury Secretary?
Well, you know, honestly, could they have picked a more perfect person to marry the two sections? They've not really, the central bank, the Fed has not really been independent. That's just a title to make you kind of feel better, but you also can't audit them. But right. I think that with Janet Yellen now becoming the Treasury Secretary, any vestiges of that independence, it should be gone, please. And, you know, welcome in that, what is big? You know, the proposal is $1.9 trillion, and I think it's going to be a whole lot bigger than that.
Joe Biden said himself that that was just to begin with. The next exactly. one is going to be for green energy, climate change, racial equality, et cetera. So who knows what the price tag is going to be on that.
Exactly. This is going to be really big, but we're already, if you look at the deficit graph in the central bank or at the Fed, right, it's already at $3.2 trillion. In 2008, we did $1 trillion. So we're starting at a huge deficit. Does it really not matter?
Right.
Because that's why they have to keep interest rates low. Interest rates are their key tool, but they have to keep those interest rates. They have to go negative because how are they going to burn off that debt? And they're going to take on a whole lot more.
Hmm.
And there's this huge movement through the cities, it seems, for universal basic income, which they're going to have to distribute so that people feel comfortable spending because that monetary velocity chart is abysmal. It was already worse in 2013 than it was in 1933, and it's a lot worse than that now. Mm. So what that really means is that people don't feel secure in their income. And therefore, they're really not spending. But if they knew they were going to get, I mean, I've heard as little as $500 a month. I've heard, you know, $4,000 a month. And that could be per person because there's not going to be any means testing. But yeah. If you knew you were getting $4,000 a month every month, then you're going to start to spend. So the $600 they sent, okay, if they send another $1,200, that's one shot. And people saved mostly, I mean, many had to use it for their living expenses, but God, $600 doesn't even cover a month's living expenses.
Well, let's assume that everyone's getting $4,000 a month. Let's just say
let's say that's the
magic number. What does that do to the stock market with all these millennials with the Robinhood account buying Tesla? And I mean, is that like Mises' version of the crack up boom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you look at during all hyperinflationary events, the stock market goes straight up.
Yeah, right.
But after all, it is denominated in the currency that is going straight down.
Straight down faster, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I've never said it's that I think we're going to have a crash tomorrow. We're going to have a... No. They've already committed to supporting that stock market because that's what the central bank can do. They can just create more debt, more money. The government spends it. But look at how long they've been talking about infrastructure. And I was just looking at this yesterday. When you're looking at a graph, a long-term graph on infrastructure spending, it looks pretty abysmal. But they always pull that out and say, well, we've got to have infrastructure spending. So rather than giving it to those that are putting the money in the stock market, why don't you repair the roads and the bridges?
Hmm.
Why don't you put more money into the schools and into the general infrastructure and into the energy grid?
Right.
Which is ancient.
It goes back down daily.
You know, and it's that's going to be really, I think, a worldwide phenomenon that we're going to see, even if there isn't an attack on the grid. So, you know, they can say anything they want and it sounds good, but personally, actions speak louder than words. And that's definitely true when you look at central banks and what they're doing for themselves, which is they're buying gold.
Yeah, right.
Why? It's an ancient relic. Why are you buying it?
Yeah.
Because they also know what they're doing to destroy the currency. And all of these people that are married to the legal money of the state.
Yeah.
But that's not as direct as the digital dollar.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Lynette, I want to read something real quick. I know the viewer, you're not going to be able to see this, but I just used this in a video I did today, and I want to read it to you because I know you are really going to get a kick out of this.
Okay. Well, you know me pretty well now, George. So
Let me. Okay, here it is. This is a blog post from the World Economic Forum.
Oh,
our
yeah.
Our favorite people, right? And so I don't know if Klaus wrote this or who, but they're talking about Triffin's dilemma, how this can be avoided. And they're talking about how we need to de-dollarize and we need to go on to a global digital reserve currency, which of course they're saying is the SDR. So this is what they're referring to. And America's outsized influence over the monetary system reduced. So this is, to them, would be a good thing. All that is needed is a major reserve currency that is not issued by a national authority, SDR. Now, here's the part you're going to love. Gold was once supposed to fill this role, but it couldn't meet demand for global liquidity, and it isn't a store of value.
So I would like them to prove that. Because over all these years, if you had an ounce of gold, you could buy a great suit of armor, you could buy a great men's suit, and you can still buy that great men's suit. It is just the opposite. And, you know, yeah, you're right. You got me going on that. Because much as they say that there's not enough to fill the demand, there's plenty of gold out there. It's just the price at which they have suppressed.
Yeah, right.
Right? So, I mean, what garbage. And of course they're going to go there because gold is invisible and private. And it runs no counterparty risk. So you hold it, you own it outright, and you can move an awful lot of wealth in a little teeny package.
Right.
Digital, well, you can transfer a whole lot of wealth almost invisibly, like inflation did on the currency. Once we're all digital, they have full control. They can eliminate its value and hit your principal just like that. And there's not anything, if that's where all your wealth is held, there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Wow. Surprised. They always make these kinds of stupid statements that it's like, and back that up.
Yeah. And I I took it out of context. I didn't want to read the whole thing. But if you read the whole article, what they're implying about gold is that it couldn't meet the market's demand for a store of value. And which is, again, is the complete opposite. The market has been choosing gold as a store of value for the last 5,000 years. I mean, it's like, it's just absolutely amazing. One thing I've been saying in my videos recently, and this is to your earlier point, talking about the stock market just going up, but the value of the dollar going down. I've been talking about a stock market crash. Mm-hmm. But the question that I've been asking is, does the stock market crash down or does it crash up? Because we think of a stock market crash as it going down by 50%, down by 90%, down by, you know, whatever. But it can actually crash up. And I used a chart I think you get a kick out of from the Venezuelan stock market. And right. If you look at a chart, what's funny is from 2013 to I think 2017, it does this, you know, parabolic kind of exponential growth curve. But then in 2018, it comes all the way back down to one.
Yep.
So you ask, well, what on earth happened then? And here's what the central planners in Venezuela, this is the brilliant, clever solution they came up with. Their stock market went from 100 in 2013 to 10 million in 2017, 2018. And they saw that it was just going up by, call it $1 million a day or a million bolivars a day. And that this was a big, big problem. And it showed how bad the hyperinflation was in the country. So their solution was just from that point moving on, they just divided the stock market number by 10 million. And there you go. Problem solved, Lynette. So the stock market went from 10 million all the way down to one. The problem is within another year or so, it was all the way back up to 100,000, which if you do the math, means that it went from 100 in 2013 up to 1 trillion in, call it, 2019. That is an example of exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
The stock market crashing up.
And yes, and I would say first it crashes up and then it crashes down.
Yeah.
And that is how they reset everything, except that they don't change behavior. They just change the way they account for all of this behavior and call it good. And they've done the same thing, George, with derivatives, right? We know derivatives caused the 1998, we almost had, that was long-term capital management, and by hair's breadth, the world was prevented from seeing the crash in the derivative market that almost took the whole world down. That happened again then in 2008. But if you look at the number of derivatives, there are so many more now, except what they did was they came out with compression and netting. So they offset this derivative over here to that derivative over there, and then that cancels each other out.
Right.
And it's still higher than it was in 2008. And now it is completely integrated throughout the stock market, throughout the ETFs. And hey, they have programs showing people how to do these derivatives. But those derivatives have nothing, they're just a bet. There's nothing substantial underneath them. So, you know, I mean, this next derivative, because that's what I think is going to tip us, it could very well be the interest rate derivatives, because that's most of the market anyway.
Yeah.
But when that piece explodes with their balance sheets and the government balance sheets where they are, I mean, how much confidence do you think the public is really going to have in them this next big crisis? I don't think they're going to be able to.
What do you think happens to gold in that scenario, Lynette, the kind of this, everything that we're talking about with the inflation, with the SDR, with what I think what you've called a monetary reset with these derivatives. And my main reason for asking the question is, in your professional opinion, do you see gold just going up with the rate of inflation, therefore just maintaining purchasing power? Or do you see it going up higher because everyone's just trying to find anything, any hard asset that will retain value. Therefore, it goes up higher than the rate of inflation and increases purchasing power.
Well, for one thing, that is monetary. That is monetary. Gold and silver are both monetary at their base. So if we're having a crisis with the money, which we are, then you want money that holds its value. And it doesn't hold its value because I say it holds its value. It holds its value because it has the most functionality of any asset that's out there, period. And I say that because I don't know why people don't talk about this more, but it's used across the entire economic spectrum. So it's used in manufacturing, it's used in the monetary system, it's used in art, it's used in food, it's used in medicine, every single aspect of the global economy, which means that it has the broadest base of buyer. So when you were talking about market demand and all of that before, it has the broadest base of demand.
Yeah.
Tell me one other asset or instrument that does that. Because I can't figure out one of them. So that's why it's the true flight to safety asset. And that's why global central banks have been accumulating it like crazy. Because as the rest of the system implodes, you know, then there is a true flight to safety. But my concern really, like my concern never has been whether or not the stock market's going to go up or it's going to crash. Ultimately, it will crash. But right now, while they still have, people still have confidence in those dollars.
Yeah.
And they are expanding the programs to get the naive public involved in their fiat game. You know, I mean, that's a big one. That is something that happens before every single stock market crisis, is that the buyers brought it out and go from the people at the top that know what's going on and they're doing all of this trading. The more you have the public participating, and especially in the way that they're participating, you know, once they get the naive public fully involved and they have that digital dollar ready. I think the only reason why we have not yet made the transition is because in this country, I mean, China's already running tests. And the way, and I think it's interesting the way they're running the tests, which is by giving people digital yuan.
Okay,
here you go. Go spend it. Right? And so that's the way they're going to do it. That's why they set up, the FedNow accounts, what, last October? When they were running the tests for the $80 trillion in derivatives, which failed, and we know that it failed not because they let it be visible to us, but because they postponed that interest rate LIBOR transition on most of it for 2 years, 2023. But 2023 is also the year that the Fed anticipates having the digital dollar ready. So why did they set up all these FedNow accounts and make these huge announcements for something that they're not going to be ready with for 2 years? I mean, you know, why? I can't really figure that one out. Can you?
Well, I don't know what their rationale was for at the time. I just know that what we've been seeing as far as the narrative that's been coming out of the Fed, the politicians, the IMF, the World Economic Forum, is all moving in the direction of more money printing, merging the balance sheets, combining the government with the central banks, and creating more of these digital currencies that are not decentralized, but quite the opposite. They're centralized and controlled. Now, if the Fed now accounts have something to do with that, I don't know, but I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, now I think everything they're doing is moving that direction, especially if they want to introduce negative interest rates, like you were saying before.
That's
pretty much the only way to do is ban cash and go that route. So everyone's purchasing power is in the system.
Absolutely. But You know, I'll tell you some of the things that I've been thinking about as I've been working on this one piece especially.
Yeah.
And if you remember, when the Fed first came into play, 1913, they allowed gold and the new Federal Reserve note to run simultaneously and be interchangeable, right? So that people didn't realize that anything had changed, when in reality, everything had changed. Mm-hmm. And the value, the real value of that $20 gold coin, because of all the new money that they printed. Remember, first it was 1-to-1. Then when the Fed came in, it was 2.4-to-1. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then as this whole evolution occurred, well, it was much different, and that, and it got broader. But I think what's also happening, and I think part of what's happened with cryptocurrencies and bringing in the digital currencies, right?
Yeah. They're,
and cash. They know that if they immediately ban cash, that it's going to be obvious to the public that something has changed. Mm-hmm. They want you to volunteer it. So if you look at the Fed's or the Bank for International Settlements monetary flower, money flower, you can see where they will allow all of these things to kind of run simultaneously.
Mm.
Now, that's just all fact. Everybody can find it. My opinion is for a while. Then once everybody is fully integrated and comfortable with the system, that's when they take away the cash.
Right, right.
Right? So initially the new cash will have that chip, so that when they go negative, so will that cash that you've taken out of the bank. The old cash, so cash, I don't think the chip is in there yet, but if you take cash out of the bank right now, it likely doesn't have that chip in there yet. And so that's considered cash in the wild. So even though through inflation, that's going to lose all of its value, initially, before people really understand what's happening with the hyperinflation, that cash will have more value. And the cryptos too might have more value in terms, in nominal terms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But ultimately, if you listen to Janet Yellen also talk about the cryptocurrencies being a good place for, you know, illicit activity and criminals and all of that, just like cash. So they're setting that up
to
justify their behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
But totally. They have to do it in a way that we just go along and go, well, yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of blog posts from the World Economic Forum and the IMF recently, and it's the exact same thing. Whenever they bring up cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin, it's always, oh, it's criminals, it's drug dealers, it's terrorists, and that's why we can never, ever use a decentralized cryptocurrency. It has to be controlled by the government, the IMF, the central bank, etc.
Yeah. Can I say those criminals?
Yeah, those. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's the iron.
And the other thing I would like to point out too is, you know, for people when they're everybody's got to be diversified and do what they're comfortable doing, but at the end of the day, what we're looking at is a complete currency reset globally, fiat currency reset.
Right.
So when you look at how they do, central banks and governments do the reset, it is against gold because this has no intrinsic value. That's all intrinsic value. Do you think they're going to reset their fiat money against private cryptos?
Yeah. Or what about, do you think they'll reset it to SDRs?
Well, I think they'll reset it into SDRs, but they've got to revalue this against something that's tangible, or right, not necessarily something that's tangible. They've got to reset the currency that has no intrinsic value. The only way that you revalue that is against something that's all intrinsic value.
Yeah, so to restore confidence.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. So that's why, you know, I think that people need to just kind of think about it. do everything. We definitely know cryptos are here to stay on some level, even inside of that current biz, you know, money flower.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, when they do the reset, what will they reset the currency against? Because they can't do it against air. And I don't think they're likely to do it against Bitcoin either. Do you?
As far, that's a tough question, because as far as resetting a currency and backing it up by a reserve asset or commodity, I see that as a probability. I see the price of Bitcoin going to 100,000 or even greater as a higher probability of them backing up a government currency with Bitcoin.
You actually think that they would back up a government currency with a private cryptocurrency? Or did I mishear you?
I mean, the probability is above zero. I don't know how far. I mean, if you're looking at a country like Venezuela, as an example, they might not have a choice. It's not even a matter of what they want to do. It's a matter of what they can do. And if that's the only option, then, you know, that could be the only option. I mean, you look at countries like Ecuador that completely replaced their currency with the United States dollar, right, which completely eliminated their control to print their own currency or to have their central bank do anything. So that was not their choice. That was forced upon them. And so I think that there may be some governments that fall into that category for Bitcoin as well. As far as the United States or a developed economy doing it, no, I think the probability is extremely low. But there is a very interesting Trojan horse type of argument. And I don't know if it would come to fruition, but there's some smart guys and gals that have a really fascinating argument for that. But that would take us another, my goodness, 2 or 3 hours. The bottom line is the way I set up my portfolio, Lynette, is 10, 80, 10. So 10% is insurance. To me, that's physical gold. And that's because I'm not buying it to get rich, I'm buying it to stay rich or just maintain purchasing power. 80% of my portfolio is what I consider investments. That's stuff that pays me to own it, like rental property, like real estate, like farms, stuff that has a yield that makes sense from the day you buy it. And then the 10% side, the other 10% would be a speculative asset, so it doesn't pay you. I just see asymmetry. So uranium might be an example. Bitcoin would be another example. I do not see Bitcoin and gold as competing asset classes.
Yeah, I don't either, really.
They're just completely, they have a completely separate function in my portfolio.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with that. You are definitely more heavily weighted than I am in real estate. Because I think that right now, with the market as high as it is, look, you got to have a place to live. You got to have a place to bug out. You know, you have to make a place. You have to have a place to create your last stand. But with prices as high as this, if you have the gold to offset what you're buying, that's fine. But you definitely need a balance in there. I'm definitely all in with, you know, I do have a little bit of real estate, but I look at that as a place to live, a place to bug out. And I'm all in.
Keep in mind though, that 90% of my real estate is outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the real estate I do have here, I'm in the process of selling. I've got renters in there with leases, and I've notified my property management company that as soon as those leases are done, the properties are going on the market.
Because
I don't know if we're at a top.
Smart man, George.
I don't know if we're at a top. And I've been selling them since 2018. But I don't know if we're at a top. The market could double, could triple from
right,
here.
Right, it could.
But my core investment philosophy is don't try to time the market. Don't try to figure out where the prices are going. Just ask yourself if it's cheap or if it's expensive. If it's cheap, buy it.
Buy it.
It's expensive, sell it.
Sell it.
There you go. That's
perfect. That goes to the fundamental value that I talk about all the time. And so if you're looking out in that universe, what's cheap, George? Gold and silver. Dirt cheap. Because a rising gold price is an indication of a failing currency.
Yeah, especially when you compare it to the M2 money supply.
Voila.
I know we've got an hour, Lynette. Do you have another 5 minutes or so?
For you, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Because one thing that we never really talk about, I never talk about on my channel, I know you talk about it a bit, is kind of this self-sustainability.
Yes.
And I always talk about a plan B is maybe having an RV and a diesel truck in your driveway that you can just kind of head up to the mountains if it hits the fan or if we get some social unrest, or maybe having a second passport or a bank account overseas, maybe a visa or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you talk about just getting a piece of property and farming solar, wind. We've talked about properties that you might purchase that fall into that category. I've been over to your house several times, which I might add is right in the middle of Phoenix. I won't mention where, but it's in an urban area. You've got a big lot and you grow more food there than, I mean, it's like a Whole Foods times 10. I mean, she's got every single fruit tree you could possibly imagine, every vegetable. She has tilapia growing in her swimming pool that she turned into a pond. She has chickens, she has quail, she has ducks. She has, I mean, she could feed like half of Phoenix with just her property. So explain to us kind of why you think that could be another plan B that that people might want to consider.
Well, really, because I feel you need to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible. That doesn't necessarily mean individual, because, you know, as you stated, people do come over there, over here and help out, etc. So it's community as well. But that goes to everything, because food becomes the single biggest issue as we go, for most people, as we go through this transition. And I think even now we see that more people are dying from starvation than they are from the coronavirus. So you want to make sure that, and I started it because I believe my research, I wanted to feed my family, which my extended family was maybe about 20 people. But I don't really know how to do things in a small way.
Hey, you could feed 200,000 people.
I don't know that it's that big, but I really know that I need to be able to feed as many people as I possibly can. And so I've always focused on creating production. But it's also water. I mean, I'm in Arizona. We're in drought. But still, you can't live without food and water. You can live without a lot of other things, but you've got to have food and water. Right. So that's really why I converted my pool into a pond. It eliminates chemicals. I will have to filter it through my Berkey water filter. But, you know, it's water. And I actually have, I think, 5 ponds on the property. I only have a half an acre. I don't really have this huge lot. It's just a half an acre. But it's because you need to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible. Yeah. Because as we saw in March and April, the grocery, and actually, didn't we see that again? Didn't you send me pictures, Jacqueline, of grocery store shelves going bare, right? The supply chains are broken, right? Whether that's food or there was something. Oh yeah, I need a little paring knife. You know, big deal, a paring knife. I have to wait until February for the paring knife. The supply chains are broken. They did not get fixed between March and now. So it should be really clear to people that they need to be able to meet their as many needs as they possibly can, or come together as a group, like you mentioned, somebody coming over and helping. Well, you come over, you help, you harvest, you know, you take home food. And if there is unrest, I mean, there are things I can control and things I can't control. Right. What I can control is showing up and doing the work. So I specifically put in what I call a food hedge around my property, so that if somebody is walking by and they're hungry, they can pick a pomegranate, they can pick a pear, they can pick some food. And I'm hoping that they'll come back the next day to get more food rather than destroying the tree that's giving them food.
Yeah,
but
right.
I mean, that I can't really control, but I can control showing up and doing that. So it's food, water, energy, security, barterability, wealth preservation, community, and shelter. Yeah. That's my mantra, because those are the things that we all need. I have a lot of medicinal plants in here to help, you know, if you get sick, because, hey, you know, if you need something, that may or may not be available to you. And right. certainly when we're in hyperinflation, pharmacy shelves also go bare. So I have attempted to do everything that I could, and people know, you know, I'm telling everybody, look at your holes. We had a little taste of what it's going to be like in March and April. What did you hear yourself go, wow, I wish I had that, or darn it, right? Make sure that you fill those holes in. For me, it was not a big deal because of all of the food and everything. And so maybe I didn't get to eat avocados for a while. That's okay. I didn't go hungry. I had really good, fresh, nutritious food. But you want, my hole was the bug out. That's where my hole was. I didn't have someplace off grid to go. So I've been working on getting that plugged. It's been a little challenging, but I'll get it done. I promise. I will get it done.
The last thing you need to provide for people, Lynette, is you need to plant a toilet paper tree, because that's the biggest problem people had back in March and April.
Too true. Jacqueline was one of them. She called me up, freaked out because she didn't have toilet paper. And I'm like, don't worry about it. And what did I give you for a gift this year at the holidays? Toilet paper. I give everybody and paper towels. I give everybody toilet paper and paper towels and tissues and those kinds of things because we all need them. But actually, grape leaves would work great for toilet paper. So you can plant grapes. There's your toilet paper tree.
You already got it figured out.
I totally have that figured out. Yes.
All right. Well, we have got a huge announcement for everyone that stayed to the end of the video. So Saturday, January the 30th, just so happens to be my birthday. Oh,
yay!
You know, they come every once in a while. And I rented a venue in Old Town Scottsdale. I rented the entire place, the whole bar. It's a wine bar, whiskey bar. It's ours for the night. We've got live music, and I've got a few very special guests that are going to be there. We're going to do kind of a meet and greet type thing, and it's limited to the first maybe 100, 120 people that RSVP, and we'll put a link to do that right in the description below. But Miss Lynette Zhang herself is going to be one of my special guests. She is going to be there. So if you want to come have a beer or a cocktail or a glass of wine with myself and Lynette, maybe a couple other of my friends that you might recognize, enjoy some conversation with other like-minded people, and enjoy some live music, definitely check out the link in the description below, and hopefully we'll see you next Saturday. Lynette,
fun.
Are you ready for this?
I'm gonna be wearing a mask.
Yeah, what? Yeah, I've rented the whole venue, so yeah, you can wear a mask. You cannot. It's going to be completely up to the people there. It's their choice, like I feel it should be. So we're going to have a lot of fun. And Lynette, as always, thank you so much for your time. Loved the conversation, and I can't wait to do it again. Where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, I have a YouTube channel too, so ITM Trading, if you just go in there. And also on our blog, so itmtrading.com. And they can even call us, 888-696-4653, because really, you know, we're all like a big family. And I'm glad that you're part of our family.
I've even been to the offices. I've met everyone. It's a great, great group.
Thank you so much.
All right, Lynette. We'll see you Saturday.
I look forward to it. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.
Yeah.